Me oh me, oh my oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Welcome to Western Skies, KRCC's news and culture magazine that takes a look at issues facing Colorado and the West. This month, we're talking about the military. We'll talk about the adjustment from military to civilian life.
We're not all broken.
Explore crisis intervention.
The very qualities that are absolutely essential for us to have an effective military at the same time can serve as a risk factor for suicide.
And hear about the intersection of war and art.
To ignore what we do in war and what war does to us is to move willfully toward ignorance and pretense.
All that and more in this edition of Western Skies. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Out here on the front range, looking for a good old time. Me and my friends are headed a little further on down. Me, oh my, oh my. I'm looking at the western sky.
Thanks for tuning in to Western Skies, a collaboration between the news department and the Big Something here at KRCC. I'm Andrea Chalfin. Colorado is no stranger to the military. From active bases to a large veteran population, many residents have some kind of association with the armed services. This month for Western Skies, we're exploring some of those relationships. Our roundtable focuses on some of the processes and challenges when it comes to transitioning out of the military and the programs available for retiring service members. Our guests are Jennifer Soland, a peer navigator with Aspen Point and a Marine Corps veteran, Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Weber, Chief of Behavioral Health at Fort Carson, and Donna Finical, a licensed clinical social worker and founder of Welcome Home Warrior. That's based in Woodland Park and provides retreats for veterans and their families. Donna starts the conversation, which begins with personal motivation.
One of the things that motivated me was I had a brother who was a combat veteran from Vietnam. And the other thing that happens, I think, is that when you work with veterans, which I did at the VA, it becomes kind of like a mission. They're on a mission, and you become on a mission to try to do something to help them. And then when I established my little nonprofit, it was because I could see that families were not receiving enough help to cope with the problems that were coming home with the soldiers.
Mine initially, I enlisted in 1989, so I was used to be infantry, and knew that is a very hard life, for a long term. So I was always doing, extra things, and I kind of got associated with a good mentor. And my lieutenant helped me get into West Point. And so then from West Point, I had other mentors and kind of led me through the med school and to deploy. So, I mean, really to be a doc, or any provider, really, it's to relieve suffering.
Well, going through the transition myself, I was lucky that I was able to have a strong family unit to take me through the process. And I got into college, and that was really my main focus. But I was in the reserves at the end of my career, and I saw the hard times that my Marines were going through with the transition. Coming back from Iraq during the first parts of the war, there wasn't, unfortunately, as much community support out there. And so we were helping each other. But when I found out about the Peer Navigator program, it was all I wanted to do to work in this program and to be able to help the vets through the process that, I made it through, but I definitely saw some that didn't make it through as easily. So just every day being able to have a vet sit next to me and be able to help them through the process and have some insight and provide that little bit of hope that they may not have had in any other situation.
The life of a soldier or a Marine in general seems to have a lot of stressors. Deployment, reassignment, is there sort of a cumulative effect of these stressors that can happen simply from being in the military?
I would say yes. It's extremely difficult the longer the service, I think, to come back. And I noticed it in the retreats I was doing. I've done some since 2008, and each year the whole situation has worsened. And these are people that were doing multiple deployments. And I've noticed the difference between Vietnam and this group of soldiers in these wars is that multiple deployments definitely, in my opinion, compound the effects and negative effects of the exposure to all the things that the war zone, and then back and forth of the families. The whole family's affected.
Jennifer?
I'll definitely speak from my personal point of view. My husband, my first husband at the time, we were both in the Marine Corps, and unfortunately our marriage didn't last through the deployments. It was a lot of things between him being deployed at different times, myself being deployed later. And we also went through different things as a woman in the Marine Corps. That's its own ball game. But it was very hard, especially he got hurt when he was deployed, and he unfortunately was not allowed to stay in. And I saw what that did to his self-esteem and things like that. But that was a direct reflection of the deployment. So, and then also you really do feel like no one understands you. It's hard. That's why so many vets congregate together, is because we're the only ones that get what we went through and kind of have that automatic understanding with each other.
Just to kind of mirror what these other two ladies are saying is that there is a lot of stressors. And so I think we are a slice of society. And so then we take what America gives to us. But also, you know, some people are pretty troubled before they came in or have other kind of life stressors. And so there's a lot of things that America imparts onto us, and then we kind of put them in a disciplined manner. We institutionalize them, one might say, and build them back up. And the deployments are a stressor. They're a stressor. We know clinically that deployed families, they have a higher divorce rate. They have more problems with aggression for the kids at school, a lot more primary care visits, a lot more behavioral health visits. Although the one caveat, and it actually kind of builds on what you said, Jennifer, is the cohesion. And so the one thing that has been protective, no matter the deployments, and I think they even did a study with up to four or five, was the cohesion of the unit. And so that command climate and that cohesion was also very protective. And so sometimes if somebody is taken from that, that is the biggest deal. And the Army understands this as well. We even have a program where somebody, when they come back from a deployment, we're not going to move them, because we know that that stabilization after the deployment is very, very important, not only for the family, but also for the unit, because these are their brothers and sisters in arms. And so that level of cohesion has really been protective. And when we've looked at big studies, you know, 10,000, 50,000, kind of looking at retrospective aspects of a study, the behavioral health, the medical boards, the chapters, they're all decreased in the high cohesive units.
I see you nodding, Donna.
Yes, I was just contrasting how it was after Vietnam, because I was there when these soldiers were coming back from Vietnam, and they didn't have all of this. It was in Vietnam one day and home the next, and they didn't have any of that period of time to debrief or that camaraderie or anything. They were extremely alone and isolated, and also in a hostile environment, because they were not welcome back. And they still suffer from that even now today, you know. So it's changed for the better. And I can say, even since 07, when I started my nonprofit, they're doing a much better job in the military and all over in the community for families, for the whole family.
How much, just for a little bit of perspective, what percentage of soldiers require some sort of behavioral health treatment versus those who adjust okay?
Well, I mean, currently Fort Carson, I don't have all the demographics for the whole Army, you know, but, you know, anywhere from 10 to 30% if you look at some of the literature. But as far as making contact, because we have things before you deploy and after you deploy, so there's actually 100% contact and offering of services. And the majority will decline. And even when we've looked at completed suicides, very tragic and unfortunate, most of those have never actually ever seen behavioral health. You know, they've never had contact with behavioral health. And some have a mental disorder, but some do not. Some is that stress level, the frustration, the things that are going on in their life that has come to a head, unfortunately. And so those are kind of the numbers. I would say about 30% that are actually engaged in treatment would be a safe number, but I don't know the exact specifics.
I've heard that same number mentioned for the number percentage of folks that have PTSD, and so that's an interesting number.
Well, I would. There's different literature on the PTSD, and it goes all over the place. Approximately, because we know many, many years, and we've had the PTSD for quite a long time, about 8 to 10% of the population meet all the criteria of PTSD. There are other variants of that. And so sometimes they're including the anxiety disorder NOS and the other kind of aspects for that 30%, because 30% of true PTSD with all the criteria seems a tad high, but yeah.
Well, when someone moves to transition out of the Army, you know, what is the general procedure, and what's the role of the behavioral health offices during that process?
Well, sure. I mean, if they're actively engaged, they're actively engaged. And then you're going to have different types. So if they're in the Med Board process or the IDIS, which is the Integrated Disability Evaluation System, that's our connection with the VA. And those people in the IDIS actually will have a VA appointment before they actually leave the military. So the IDIS system tries to bridge that. The rest that are going through just a normal ETS or like to leave the service or to possibly some people are chaptered, it's still a low percentage, but there are people that go through that. But everybody still goes through a ACAP or a accession portion or transition university that kind of goes through resumes, goes through medical, goes through all their benefits and everything that they can do. But once again, it's like you can lead the horse into the water, but we can't make them drink. So they go through a pretty long time. I think we've almost doubled or even tripled from whenever I was enlisted, the time that they spend during that transition university or that ACAP service. Some people even start like a year out now.
Jennifer.
We're doing a big push right now. We do have some new programs at the Peer Navigator. We're trying to basically be the one that catches them when they leave the transition university. So they're going to go through all of the processes while they're on active duty. And sometimes it sets in and sometimes it doesn't, unfortunately, and then they get to the real world and they realize that maybe I should have paid a little bit more attention. Maybe not. It just depends. But our big goal right now with the Peer Navigators is to be that one that catches them when they come out, so that they're not, when they do leave active duty, it can be quite a shock. And you've learned all this. Now we're going to be that continuation on to actually help you meet those goals. So,
and I got to say that, I mean, yes, we couldn't do our job without the VA, but I really got to give accolades to the community, especially the Colorado Springs community. As I mentioned before, I've never seen like all the hospitals come and we discuss cases, you know, people that are inpatient, but it's also these partnerships. That's why I don't know specifically your program, because there are so many of people that are great that are reaching out. And really the partnership with the community has been pretty amazing here in Colorado Springs.
Actually, this is a role model for other states in the U.S., I think.
We met with Senator Bennett's task force as far as trying to help with this transition, and they're trying to use Colorado Springs to implement a program throughout at least the state, and then, you know, we'll go from there.
At what point does your organization hook up with the soldiers who are transitioning out?
We've seen them from 6 months to a year out, all the way until 20 years after they've been out of the service. So we've seen it from all ends of the spectrum. We have some specific groups that we work with, the wounded, ill, and injured, with a partnership with the USO. We work with them before they Med Board out of the Army, and then 2 years afterwards to make sure that they complete that transition. They have their own special needs. Another group that we're working with, we did just get funding from the Coors Foundation for this new under 30 program for veterans under the age of 30, and those parameters are 1 year before they get out to 2 years after, so we can help them through that process. And then sometimes veterans hear about our program and they were in the early 80s or Vietnam, and they still just don't know where to go and could use some help, maybe never got their VA services. And so we're going to connect those dots. So we really run the full spectrum.
And in my case, my retreats, we have reached out to families of deployed soldiers and also active duty and also veterans. And in the counseling, I've seen everything, you know, from all the wars. And currently I'm seeing people from Afghanistan and Iraq experiences.
So it's not like you're passing a baton. It's, you know, in some cases there could be overlap, in some cases there could be complete separation. It just runs the gamut.
I think it runs the gamut, but we at least have identified, at least in the Army at Fort Carson, and I think other programs, this is pretty standard. I mean, that we try to give as much on their plate and give them as much time as soon as they make that decision that they are going to get out. But, you know, as Jennifer said, sometimes it takes, sometimes it doesn't. But we try to at least offer and let them know everything that's available.
There's definitely some things that maybe they don't realize how difficult it could be when they get out of the military. I know many people, and I was one myself, that was like, nope, I'm just ready to go. I'm ready to get out. Let me go. Let me out the door. But then you're like, whoa, I have the rest of this big world to kind of tackle. And so maybe I should have listened when I was in that class, and now I don't know where to go or what to do. So that's the hardest transition, and that's definitely when they need a little bit more help. So the Army or the Marine Corps, the Navy can do all that they can while they're in. But unfortunately, there's going to be that group that didn't necessarily take that for good or for bad. I mean, you can look at it any way you would like, but it's really important that if they do realize they need help, that there's the community resources out there like there are in Colorado Springs.
What are the biggest issues that people who are transitioning out of the military come across? I mean, what you're describing, Jennifer, is it sounds like even the most mundane things can really create stress. So what are the issues that, number one, you try and prepare people for, but number two, that come up that might surprise people?
You can go ahead.
Donna.
Well, since my experience goes back to after Vietnam, I was just flashing back to what it was like after Vietnam, and there weren't as many services, and they hardly knew the diagnosis of PTSD, and so it was wild. Back in those bad old days, when there wasn't nearly the understanding of that we have now and all the information and help, they were floundering around. They were having big problems. And there wasn't a lot out there for them. And as far as services, way different than now. You know, the nearest VA was 60 miles away until we brought the VA clinic down in 1981. So people had to travel long distances to get help, and they were having a lot of trouble.
Sure, Jennifer.
I will definitely say employment is the biggest problem. They unfortunately, with the difficult economy that we're going through, finding employment and gainfully employed, you know, making more than minimum wage it's difficult. It's definitely very difficult. The hardest thing is to translate what they did in the military into the civilian world so an employer can understand. There's still definitely a disconnect there that we're working very hard on, but not having that paycheck every 1st and 15th is hard on a family. You know, losing homes, losing cars, working for minimum wage, no child care, everything that falls under that. Unfortunately, it's a saturated environment as far as the employment sector goes. So employment is very hard. And you know, that's what we do the most at Peer Navigators, trying to translate those skills for them, make the connections with employers so that we can get them jobs. But it's a very harsh reality to go from the prestige of being a soldier and you know, coming back from war and all of that that comes with it. And then, unfortunately, maybe having to take a job that what you feel is beneath you. It's very, very hard. And if you already have some substance abuse problems, depression issues, PTSD, that sure doesn't help the situation. It doesn't at all.
Just to kind of build on what Jennifer and Donna are saying, is the indoctrination of the military, we do have a structure. And a lot of people that kind of gravitate towards the military, even the people that you try to gravitate towards afterwards, you know, they do like that certain kind of structure. And so when they're outside of that environment, it does make things very, very difficult unless they planned accordingly. And just as what helped me get to school and get me, you know, to be educated beyond my intelligence is great mentors. And so I can definitely see the community partners having that kind of mentorship to go forward. But we have something as common in psych. It's called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so you have to take care of some very, very basic things before you can start working on depression or substance abuse. But sometimes the two are interchangeable, right? That you can't get to dealing with food and shelter and childcare if you can't take care of yourself. And so it's a big continuum to ensure that we identify that early, that we hopefully get the soldier to actually engage, and then continue.
Where do the two connect in terms of reaching out and being there, but then having them meet you halfway? I mean, is there some sort of an intersection between those two? And are some veterans just going to be lost?
Yeah, I mean, it is a big obstacle to get through. And then, you know, we talk about development, society. It gets into very, very huge societal kind of group dynamics. And one thing that kind of illustrates that, I mean, we have a little joke that how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is really only one, but the light bulb's got to want to change. And so it's just a little joke, but a little illustration. It is very difficult to get through that particular portion.
We've definitely seen there are some that come in that maybe don't want help. Maybe they think they're there because they have to be there. Maybe they're still active duty and, you know, so-and-so said they had to come in. But the way that we kind of get that buy-in is by word of mouth of those that we've helped. That's the biggest referral we get.
Donna?
I would agree. I was just thinking it's a lot like civilians, too. Sometimes things have to just crash and burn around your ears before you go in to get some help.
I would say we've had clients that maybe came in once and didn't come back for 6 months, but in 6 months we're going to get a phone call and they're going to say, okay, I'm ready. Now I want some help and this happened. And unfortunately it is their rock bottom, but and that's fine. No grudges held that you didn't come to an appointment. Doesn't matter. We're here now when you need us. And that's the important part.
Is there a predictor of that? Can you tell if someone says that they don't want treatment anymore, that somebody's going to be, you'll eventually see them again?
The substance abuse sometimes can be a very big one if maybe they're not ready to get past that yet. Sometimes you have to let them kind of go handle that and get to the point where they want to find out that that's ready. Sometimes just things getting bad enough, there's pride involved and no, I can do it. I want to do it. And I understand that we all have that pride, but you know, unfortunately, sometimes when family's involved, the pride has to take a back seat, and that will be the time. It really just depends on the client that walks through the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult to determine, but you still, after building a little bit of time and seeing thousands of patients, you get a feel of when this person might engage or when they might never. And so, you know, we do what we can. We offer, ensure that the hand is always open. There's no judgment or anything, and we'll meet you where you're at is kind of the mantra that we try to say.
I might add the aging process has something to do with when people come in, because I remember World War II veterans who came in after Iraq started and they were watching the war on TV and they were starting to remember and starting to have flashbacks and nightmares. So it's sort of like that. If you don't deal with it, it deals with you at some point. Especially when you have things like PTSD.
And I think just to add on that, it's the functional impairment. And so that's why, you know, those World War II, those Vietnam, there's a lot of them that were functional, that were impaired, but not until X happened. And I don't know what X is. X is different substances, a divorce, a move, a loss of a job. I mean, there's a lot of stressors in life. I don't know what that X could be, but that they were functioning at some level. And so when you do start talking to somebody, it's that level of functioning. If they're on unemployment, their wife is about to leave them, their kids are, you know, in truancy and doing drugs, that's somebody that definitely needs our assistance.
What does a community like Colorado Springs, the Pike Peak region, a place that deals with a lot of veterans, really need to understand, actually, about these people who are leaving the military, these people who do need these support services? Jennifer?
I have a very big comment on that. We're not all broken. Just because we have some issues and we've gone through some things and maybe they do have PTSD or TBI, something like that, that doesn't mean we're broken and it doesn't mean that we can't be viable members of society. I think it's a misconception.
Well, that's, yeah, like we said earlier, I mean, there's a lot of different wars. We've had many years in PTSD. Some even said, I said the Iliad and everything is because some people think that was a catharsis for PTSD, you know, for Homer. And so that's been here since war has been here. And so people are still functional. People can still perform, can still excel and do great things. So really building on those, that the veterans could have problems, but they're good, you know.
Donna?
I think it would be to treat them like anyone else with respect.
That was Donna Finical, founder of Welcome Home Warrior, Lieutenant Colonel Chuck Weber, Chief of Behavioral Health at Fort Carson, and Jennifer Soland, a peer navigator with Aspen Point. The full conversation is available online at krcc.org. We'll be right back with more Western Skies.
looking at the western sky.
Welcome back to Western Skies, where we're talking about the military. If you've ever wondered how it is that the Pikes Peak region became home to so many military installations, wonder no further. Big Something producer Noel Black has this reading of Marshall Sprague's account from Newport in the Rockies, his history of the Pikes Peak region.
Even before Spencer Penrose's death, several community leaders had been toting up assets and considering new uses for them. It was plain to them that since war was the world's business, then Pikes Peak must go to war too. They decided to seek a small military installation, costing a modest million or so. The city acquired 35,000 acres of land for them to use as bait. Their immediate problem was to educate high government officials. Colorado had never been admired for military purposes by the Army, not even in the 1860s when General Kit Carson had commanded a shabby troop at Fort Garland in the center of Trinchera Ranch. To change the Army's attitude, Russell Law and Chase Stone began flying bat-like between Pikes Peak Avenue and Constitution Avenue, a two-man lobby so unobtrusive that other lobbyists in Washington assumed that they were freshman congressmen. They studied the faults of towns which were failing to get installations, and they prepared charts on the springs to rebut whatever objections might arise. But the main objection, an entrenched myth, seemed insurmountable. Everyone in Washington was sure that the Pikes Peak region was snowbound from October to June. Government statistics which proved the opposite were ignored on Capitol Hill, or regarded as propaganda. At a final Springs hearing, Coordinator Knudsen succumbed to irritation and blasted Chase Stone for wasting his committee's time. No American boys were going to be sent to Pikes Peak for Army training to freeze to death in the deep drifts. Stone, hitherto a model of politeness, chose to be brusque. "Mr. Knudsen," he said, "may I ask when it was you saw snow in Colorado Springs?" Knudsen thrust out his chin. "I can tell you exactly," he said. "The month was December. The year was 1913. Stone stood up, drawing from his briefcase a spring snow chart dating back to the reports of Sergeant O'Keefe. "That's right," he said to Knudsen and to the committee in general. "There it is on the chart, that high point there. We call it the Big Snow. As you see, such a fall has happened just once since 1873. Knudsen capitulated. Within hours, the deep snow of Pikes Peak melted all along the Potomac as though warmed by a Chinook wind. Soon, Army generals and their staffs began appearing at the Broadmoor Hotel, where the latch string was out and the red carpet unrolled. When they asked how to reach the city's proffered 35,000 acres, presumably remote to keep the town from being contaminated by uncouth soldier boys, they were led to a hotel window and shown the site adjoining Broadmoor and Strattonholme, clear evidence that Springs residents really wanted the camp in their midst. And still, Russell Law and Chase Stone were not hopeful. And then in 1941, the word came. The Army selected the Springs site for a 30 million post to be called Camp Carson in honor of Kit Carson, who had chewed beaver tail along Monument Creek a century before. Some months later, 1,650 buildings were ready, and the 89th Division of 30,000 men began training under General William H. Gill. The Pikes Peak region sprang to life overnight, and before it could recover from the shock of Camp Carson, Fort Carson today, in moved the Air Force at Peterson Field in 1948 and on East Boulder Street, foreshadowing the establishment of an Air Force Base, National Headquarters of North American Air Defense Command, and its Combat Operations Center under Cheyenne Mountain. It was all too good to be true, too incredible that a small Rocky Mountain resort of 35,000 people should win two permanent military payrolls totaling $5 million a month, in competition with scores of larger, more politically potent cities. 6 weeks later, Joseph A. Reich, a restaurant owner, was thinking about spring's luck while getting his hair cut on Pikes Peak Avenue. His eye fell on an inch of type in a newspaper reporting the appointment of a congressional committee to determine the need of the Air Force for an academy of its own, like the Army's West Point. Reich read and felt a prickle at the nape of his neck. Why not try to get this Air Force academy at Pikes Peak? It wasn't possible, of course, but Camp Carson and an air base hadn't been possible either. Still, Reich mentioned the item to Howard N. "Doc" Yates, Secretary of the Chamber of Commerce. Both men thought it was a wild thought, but they saw no harm in putting in a bid, just for the publicity. The bid was put in. Soon after, Congress authorized the establishment of the Air Force Academy, and Russell Law, Chase Stone, and the others went to work to bring the Academy to the Springs. Under the circumstances, they could hardly expect even to be heard. The Air Force Academy was the national plum of plums, a $200 million industry. However, the Springs men began slowly to realize that the Pikes Peak region of Palmer and Penrose had unforeseen advantages over the other 400 areas. At the Springs, Academy jet trainers would already be more than a mile on their way to the classroom at 40,000 feet, and the most expensive flying mile at that. Obviously, the saving in jet training fuel alone over a period of years would pay for the Air Force Academy. On June 24, 1954, Air Force Secretary Talbot announced that the Academy would be built at Pikes Peak, though without fields for jet training. In September 1958, the first of an ultimate enrollment of 4,400 cadets and 500 teachers moved into the vast shining center of steel, aluminum, glass, and marble, poised on a buttress like a mesa flying out from the Rampart Range. And today the Academy stands in cool silhouette against the mountain, as beautiful as anything could be on which $200 million and more has been spent in a very great hurry.
That was Noel Black reading Marshall Sprague's account of the history of the military in the Pikes Peak region. You can listen to the piece again and see a slideshow of images from the various military installations around Colorado Springs at krcc.org. In Pueblo County, one Army installation is gearing up for its last military mission. The Pueblo Chemical Depot holds more than 500,000 shells containing deadly mustard agent, brought there in the 1950s and 60s. Now, an elaborate disassembly plant has been built to destroy these chemical weapons. But as KRCC's Liz Ruskin reports, it's not yet clear what the site will be when it enters civilian life.
There are bobcats out here. We have some coyotes, elk, deer.
15 miles from downtown Pueblo sits a fenced-off section of short grass prairie nearly the size of the city itself. It's been a military depot since World War II, storing everything from beans and bullets to confiscated Nazi art. In its heyday during the Korean War, 8,000 people worked here. Now most of its 900 storage bunkers are empty, except for 94 in an isolated corner. Those are the ones storing the chemical weapons.
You know, you hear that it's mustard gas, but in the form that we have it in, it is truly a liquid. It's like a thick motor oil.
That's Michael Strong. He's the civilian in charge of engineering for the new destruction plant built next to the chemical bunkers. He's a veteran of similar operations elsewhere in the U.S. The Pueblo weapons, plus a smaller stash in Kentucky, are the final 10% that remains of America's original chemical stockpile.
We'll take you into the next room where we have the kind of the toxic area.
Construction of the Pueblo plant is done, but the machinery isn't all hooked up yet, so Strong's tour includes chambers that will be off limits to all but robots once the weapons are brought in.
A lot of tanks in here, a lot of pumps, a lot of instrumentation. This is really where the destruction occurs.
The plant has conveyors and yellow-armed robots, even automated trucks plying one corridor. Once it's operational, robots will remove the explosives from the shell and rinse out the mustard agent, which will be neutralized with hot water and sodium hydroxide, a key ingredient in Drano. The water will then be treated with microbes and piped back into the operation. The empty shells will get baked and turned to scrap metal. The plant's other output will be what they call salt cakes that'll be sent to a toxic dump site. Bechtel has contracted to build and run the plant. Its project manager, Rick Holmes, says he expects the facility will operate for about 4 years, starting in 2015. The exact numbers aren't decided yet, but he says they'll be looking to hire several hundred people, and they've already held their first job fair.
It's transport-type people, munition handlers, people who will take the munitions and put them into the process, that type of position all the way through paramedics who are in our clinic.
What becomes of this area after chemical weapons are gone and the plant is shuttered, that's what this guy is trying to figure out.
It's Russell DeSalvo, and I am the president and CEO of the Pueblo Depot Activity Development Authority.
The state-chartered group was created in 1994, and DeSalvo says their goal is to bring jobs and expand the county's tax base. Nearly two decades later, the demand isn't so obvious for this dry rural landscape.
Some things that we're contemplating are renewable energy, law enforcement and homeland security training, Of course, industry, distribution, storage.
Of course, storage. His group already has control of about 650 storage bunkers, or igloos, as the Army calls them. More than 150 are already leased, housing items like election records, antique cars, and museum artifacts. In this climate, DeSalvo says rust and mold aren't a problem.
With the igloos being over 12 inches of solid concrete covered by earth on the sides and top, you know, the temperature is relatively constant year-round.
For $1,200 a year, you can rent your own igloo big enough for a dozen cars. For now, anyway. DeSalvo says they're working on a new plan for the area and hope to have it ready before the end of next year. For KRCC News, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western skies. Me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western skies.
We'll be right back with more Western Skies. Welcome back to Western Skies, where we're talking about the military. In 2012, the U.S. military's suicide rate surpassed combat deaths. Clinical psychologist Craig Bryan has made suicide prevention his mission. This January, Dr. Bryan's research brought him to Colorado Springs and Fort Carson, where he was beginning his second study on mental health treatments. We sat down then to talk about his research and how the very characteristics that make an effective soldier can also lead to increased suicide risk. You're obviously here in Colorado Springs right now launching a study. What is that new study that you're looking at?
This is a second treatment study that we're doing here at Fort Carson. Both studies were focused on preventing suicide and reducing suicide attempts in active duty soldiers. We are comparing three different treatment strategies for a crisis. All three treatments actually are used pretty routinely in mental health care. We just don't know, is one of them better than the other? That's what we're trying to figure out, which one really prevents suicide attempts the most effectively and has the best long-term outcomes.
What are those treatments?
For post-traumatic stress disorder, there are two treatments that are gold standard. They should be frontline therapies. They are called prolonged exposure and cognitive processing therapy. Both of those therapies have very solid research bases, have been, and at least in prolonged exposure's case, has been around for at least 30 years. Both of them have recovery rates from PTSD anywhere from about 70 to 80%. A study was just published last year that found that those effects tend to hold for up to 10 years following treatment, which is remarkable in mental health care. The therapy approaches that we are now using with suicidal patients are now consistently reducing suicide attempts by 50%. Some of the other therapies for depression would be cognitive therapy or interpersonal psychotherapy.
And are those treatments based on the previous research study that you did?
Where this has been informed by previous research is, at least in psychotherapy, in like 12-session psychotherapy, which is what we did in the previous study, we have found that, you know, problem-solving is a major deficit in suicidal individuals. And in fact, the reason why people kill themselves is because they are experiencing very high levels of emotional distress, and they're not able to solve the problem that is creating. So they become hopeless, they feel in despair, and they say the only option is to kill myself. So what we are basing some of these interventions are is how do we teach them, you know, what the alternatives are, how to not kill yourself when you want to kill yourself. The second piece of information or knowledge that we've gleaned from previous studies that we'll be testing in this one as well is a very powerful protective factor for suicide is knowing what your reasons for living are. And what we have found in our previous treatment work is you can actually train a suicidal person how to remember what is worth living for. And when you remind them and they can access memories about what is good in my life, their hopelessness drops. And they say, well, maybe I don't want to kill myself after all.
How big is your sample size?
We intend to enroll at least 360 soldiers within the next year or two.
I mean, that what tells me is that there's a lot of suicidal people at Fort Carson.
What most people don't realize, there's a lot of suicidal people within society, but they don't know it. But yeah, definitely within the military, we are seeing increased risk. You know, we're seeing increased rates of suicidal thoughts, suicide attempts, and suicide deaths. And so at any of the large military installations, the tragedy is that many of us who focus on suicide research are finding enough people to enroll in these studies.
What is different about approaching the military in these acute circumstances than in the civilian world?
I think one of the biggest differences between military personnel versus civilians is they have a very different understanding of life and death. In the military, especially in combat arms professions, we explicitly train combatants not to be afraid to die. We teach them to walk towards death and to maintain their cool and their composure, and not to be afraid to be injured, to suck it up and deal with it, to bury any discomfort that you might have, to fix your problems yourself, because if you can't, you're going to drag down the rest of the unit. And so it's this paradox that we often find ourselves in, that the very qualities that are absolutely essential for us to have an effective military at the same time can serve as a risk factor for suicide, and it's this double-edged sword. And the question that I have that some of us are trying to work on is, when does this strength become a liability? When does giving your life become distorted and turn into taking my life? And how do you teach service members to tell the difference between that? And some of the preliminary work that we found is they do understand. They know the difference between giving versus taking life. The problem is that when they become emotionally distressed, they lose the capacity to differentiate those two.
So these soldiers that you will be studying are people who self-identify as suicidal. It's not necessarily someone that a doctor has said, I think you're suicidal. How many soldiers commit suicide or attempt suicide who have self-identified versus those who don't?
You know, as long as we assume that the only way to solve the suicide problem in the military is by getting soldiers and Marines and airmen into our mental health clinics, we will never solve this problem. And it's because of that very fact. The majority of service members never show up in a clinic. And so what we need to do is augment the doctors, augment going to the doctor with prevention, with addressing quality of life issues every single day, making sure people sleep well, they eat well, they're exercising on a regular basis, they feel like they belong, they have a strong sense of social support, that they never feel like they're isolated and that they're trapped and no one cares about them. And the way we affect that is through everyday interactions with one another. You know, it's addressing small conflicts. It's even just saying hi to one another. It sounds so silly and so simple, but what we know is that these little things, when you address them every single day, prevent the snowball effect that can lead to a suicidal crisis.
You know, Fort Carson and the Army has initiated some resiliency training within the past few years. I think the latest numbers came out that showed that suicides are up. So how has resiliency training affected what you're seeing?
To say that we are frustrated would be the understatement of a lifetime. It's infuriating to be doing so much, and yet we're still seeing these numbers go up. The question, though, that you have to ask, though, that we cannot answer is, if we were not doing these things, would it be worse? I do actually suspect that it probably would be worse if we were not doing resiliency efforts, if we were not providing treatment, because the reality is that we're getting better at preventing suicide. We're getting better at treatments. And now, at least with the study here done at Fort Carson, we have some scientific data that's starting to back up a lot of these ideas, and that there are treatments that work better than others, and we can actually significantly reduce risk for suicide and improve the quality of life for service members.
That was Dr. Craig Bryan talking about his research into military suicides in his new study that began earlier this year at Fort Carson. The conversation was edited by Michelle Mercer, and the full version is available online at krcc.org. For as long as people have been at war, soldiers have sought to process the realities of combat through art and literature. For those who have not served, the imagery and stories created by those who have offer a glimpse into the otherwise unknowable truth of war. Retired Air Force officer Donald Anderson directs creative writing at the Air Force Academy and edits the international journal War Literature and the Arts. In this piece, Anderson shares his thoughts on the importance of art and literature to soldiers and society.
We have, each of us, factual histories and imagined histories, backfilling always when memory proves deficient. It gets complicated. What is remembered or imagined becomes reality. And if we don't create our personal versions of the past, someone else will do it for us. This is a frightening and political fact. Memory and imagination are the what and how we have as artists and readers and citizens, to which we must cling as if to luck or safety. Soldiers, more than anyone, know what they are capable of destroying, and I believe when they write about war, or paint it, or photograph, or film it, they are trying to preserve the world. Of course, art and life are different. If they weren't, we wouldn't need art. And if art generally strains towards making sense, most of us have lived long enough to know that life is under no such obligation. There is an obligation, is there not, as Neruda advised, to come and see the blood in the streets. It is dishonest to create art that does not reflect the world that art exists in. To ignore what we do in war and what war does to us is to move willfully toward ignorance and pretense. At their best, soldier artists affirm the power of word and image and the human craving for meaning. And if one of the functions of such art is to disturb the status quo, to force us to view the world anew, to consider our capacities to build or tear down, then we must welcome these disturbances. In war literature and the arts, we strive to include voices from many perspectives. We sense that Tim O'Brien hits the mark when he writes in How to Tell a True War Story. War is hell, but that's not the half of it. Because war is also mystery and terror and adventure and courage and discovery and holiness and pity and despair and longing and love. War is nasty. War is fun. War is thrilling. War is drudgery. War makes you a man. War makes you dead. You can tell a true war story, O'Brien goes on to write, if it embarrasses you. If you don't care for obscenity, you don't care for the truth. If you don't care for the truth, watch how you vote. Send guys to war, they come home talking dirty. In war, there is a sense that one is available for death, which is a notion that will alter forever any competing notion of invincibility. The more common vision for a 19 or 20-year-old. War is for all soldiers, as it was for young Paul Fussell, an introduction to the shakiness of civilization. The possibility of death is something that sticks. In The Soldier's Tale, Samuel Hinds takes on the issue of truth problems. He knows that any individual's perspective, especially in the carnage, chaos, and fog of war, is limited not only by one's place in the field, a trench, a tank, a cockpit, but by the infidelities of memory and the distortion of language. But nonetheless, the individual's vision, confined or not, helps make up the larger, more accurate picture. The truth of war being the sum of witnesses, the collective tale that soldiers tell. As Hinds writes, we don't need to call that convergence of witnesses historical truth, if that seems too confident. Call it instead the recoverable past of war. Such recovery is possible. It is more than possible. It is imperative. What other route do we have to understanding the human experience of war, how it felt, what it was like, than the witness of the men who were there?
Donald Anderson is the author of Gathering Noise from My Life, a camouflaged memoir, as well as other books. You can find a link to the journal he edits, War Literature and the Arts, online at krcc.org. The piece was produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell.
Me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Thanks for joining us this month for Western Skies, a production of KRCC News and The Big Something. Producers this month are Andrea Chalfin, Jake Brunell, and Craig Richardson, with technical production assistance provided by Greg Bennett. Special thanks to The Haunted Wind Chimes for our theme music, with lyrics and arrangement by Nea Lujan. The Haunted Wind Chimes are Shayla Lujan, Mike Clark, Desiree Garcia, Sean Fanning, and Inea Lujan. For KRCC News and Western Skies, I'm Andrea Chalfin.